Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, I'm Digby Jones, and welcome to the first in a special series of programmes all about how businesses, large, small, different sectors, different parts of the country, are preparing for what, with a nod to the big challenge that COVID is presenting to us all every day, is probably the most important and disruptive thing that's happened to business in the last 50 years. Welcome to Preparing for Brexit with Digby Jones. I was Director General of the Confederation of British Industry. I was Minister of Trade in the government, and I still sit on six boards, and I help other companies with their strategic directions and some management advice. And so I want in this series to go and meet real businesses, real people, people facing challenges every day, people whose decisions will dictate whether there are people in work or not next year. And I want to go to those frontline people and ask, how are you getting on? Are you prepared for January the 1st at the end of transition? And what is your business going to look like? How is it going to succeed in a post-Brexit business world? Now, each week, we're going to take a close look at one sector of the business economy in particular. We're going to talk to small businesses. We're going to look at the three F's of farming, food and fishing. We're going to look at transport, travel. We're going to look at how you get people and goods across borders. We're going to look at financial services, which is so important to our economy. But I hope you'll forgive me if we kick off this week, given where I come from in Birmingham, with a sector that contributes £191 billion into the UK economy, and 2.7 million people every day go to work and have their livelihoods dependent on it. We're going to look at manufacturing. And I'm joined each week by an expert, a friend, if you like, somebody who knows what they're talking about and can listen and then help me provide advice and guidance to these businesses and indeed to all of us listening to this programme. And this week, to look at manufacturing in detail with me, is Ali Renison. She's the Senior Trade Policy Advisor at the Institute of Directors, and she shouldn't be thought of as where her accent comes from. Yes, she had an American dad, but she had a very British mum. Hello, Ali. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
Now, you obviously talk with loads of companies at the IOD, and what a good job they do with that. So what kind of companies are you talking to at the moment all about Brexit?
Well, I think in the first instance, because we're cross-sector, which is both, I found, a blessing and a curse. You have to be both across a lot of issues, both in terms of the width and also the detail. But really, I think in terms of our membership, what I spend a lot of my time doing is speaking to the heads of companies. So the members of our institute are basically the company directors, the people running the organizations. And that really expands and closes all sectors and none, really. And I think at the moment, really, the emphasis is inevitably on dealing with, responding to, trying to understand what the new rules coming in are around COVID and the pandemic response. But there is a very keen sort of backwards eye, knowing that there are changes coming in at the end of the year. So really trying to work that through with companies, really to make sure that they understand what it is that they need to know, because that's, I think, the biggest challenge.
And do you find across the piece that they've got their head in the sand, or do you find that actually everybody is preparing for it in one way or another?
I think there's a it's a question about how you prepare. So it's not a question of head in the sands, but because I think companies, for a variety of different reasons, whether it's looking over the last 4 years at the back and forth that there was at the moment with COVID on top of everything else, and also quite frankly, simply because the negotiations aren't concluded. So the detail that you need, we know that there are general top line changes coming if you leave the single market and the customs union, but you don't know exactly what the detail are. So what we're finding is a lot of companies are saying, we've done as much preparation as we can do at the moment without having that detail, and when all that detail is clear, we will adjust.
When they're looking at those top line changes, the things that is there a commonality? Do you find that, say, there are two or three things which everybody is looking at?
I mean, if you could possibly break it down into three that's relevant for all businesses, I'd say really keeping things flowing, whether that's goods or services. So understanding what the new rules are, that's the big challenge, particularly since some of that detail is not there at the moment. But also making sure that they have everything that's in place to keep, in particular, goods, because I know we're going to be talking about manufacturing in particular, flowing. Making sure that they have spoken to all of their customers and suppliers about responsibility. That's, I call it the liability question, and making sure you know and your customers and your suppliers know when changes are made, whatever those changes are, what is the division of responsibility? So that's sort of the second big issue. And then I think the third one, really, I hate to say, is tariffs. I think, you know, some people argue about whether it's important or not, but whether we have tariffs or not, particularly I think for manufacturing, but also the economy as a whole, that's a big difference between having them or not. So I think that's a big question mark around what people are doing to prepare.
Yeah. An important part of the UK manufacturing piece is, of course, automotive, and a little later, Ali, I want to explore with you the actual figures and stats around that so we actually understand how important it is. But I want to take you all to Malvern in Worcestershire, and I want to take you to an iconic British brand. Morgan Cars is in everybody's affection. Everybody sees a Morgan, and the little lad comes out in all of us. Indeed, I was fortunate enough to do the new Troubleshooter TV series a few years ago, stepping into the boots of the late and the great John Harvey Jones. And if only I could have done it as well as he did it all those years ago. And he is, of course, the person, and I still get this thrown at me when I'm around the place, people saying, oh, yes, Troubleshooter. He's the guy who told Morgan they hadn't got a future at all. If they didn't change their ways. Well, they didn't change their ways. And of course, frankly, they are more successful, more iconic, and more proud to be a British success story than ever before. And I'm lucky today. I've been joined by Steve Morris. He's the managing director of Morgan, based in Malvern, in the Lee of the Malvern Hills. I've been there. I've been round the plant. And they've been making cars there for over 110 years. And what pleases me, and in fact, as I say this, my heart bursts, and that is that Steve joined as a sheet metal apprentice, and he's now the managing director. Every kid listening to this, or every mum and dad with a kid listening to this, just remember that an apprenticeship is one of the fabulous ways that you can get into manufacturing. Hello, Steve.
Good afternoon, Lord Digby.
Hi. You make a fair few cars in Malvern, do you not? How many are there?
Yeah, I mean, typically we make between 750 and 1,000 cars a year, dependent on the model lineup at the time. But this last year, sort of 800 cars the previous year.
And of those 800, how many are going out of our ports around the world?
There's 65 to 70% at the moment. That fluctuates, again, year on year, depending on what's going on. But typically 65 to 70% at the moment.
And of that 70%, how many of those, that's what, just over 500, isn't it? 550, something like
that.
How many of those are going to the European Union?
Between 55 and 60% into the EU.
Into the EU. So a fair bit. And obviously not every component in a Morgan is made in Britain. So what percentage of a Morgan are you bringing in from overseas?
At the moment, so we're using all BMW power at the moment. So BMW engines come in, and we use certain electronics and steering componentry from the EU. And then, of course, on the three-wheelers, we get the engines from the States, from the US, which is an S&S engine. But otherwise, a lot of the componentry is from the UK, but the engine side from the EU.
In terms of January the 1st coming down the pipe, given that export profile, given that import profile, what have you been doing about it?
Well, I think that there are a number of things we've been doing. And at the moment, obviously, with all of our European dealers, we've been talking to them about their profile for the Q1 next year, so getting the orders in. And that's a fine balance between ensuring that you're not trying to sort of overproduce and fill the channel unnecessarily.
Have you been stockpiling at all?
No. We make to order. All the cars are made to order, so dealers and distributors globally would be ordering the vehicles. But obviously, with the European Union, we've been asking those dealers if they would like to sort of pull the orders just gently forward to ensure that they beat any potential tariffs.
And have they been?
Yes, yeah. So we've got the European, and as I say, it's a fine balance between ensuring that you're not sort of stuffing the channel and overproducing where you don't need to. So, but yes, they have been. They've been with us on that journey.
And have you stocked up on your imported components as well, just in case?
Yes, we looked at, and again, there's a fine line between just how much you can do, but we work very closely with BMW and the big suppliers that we do use in Europe. So we've ensured, and of course, with couple this with the ongoing pandemic and the challenges that we've had, it's been a very dynamic situation with some of the bigger producers closing down actually earlier than the smaller producers. So that's been a challenge in itself.
Yeah, I found that on loads of businesses, actually. The smaller ones have really carried on, and God bless them. You've got 225 people, haven't you, working for you?
Yes, we have here on site in Malvern, yes.
And has that fluctuated over the last, I don't know, 3 or 4 years?
Yeah, we've very, very much so. We've increased our staff here by about 20% over the last sort of 14 or 15 months. And growing the factory, we've also invested heavily in the facilities, got a new big R&D research and development department as well to go alongside the factory.
So I'm sure that the 225 have all got masks on and they're all however you can socially distance while you put a sports car together, but I don't belittle that, but let's just leave that on one side. What's your greatest challenge as you look down a post-Brexit world? You're a quality manufacturer, value added. I say that with great respect to COVID. I'm not belittling it. But nevertheless, what would be your greatest challenge?
Obviously, the uncertainty that we're all facing on completely understanding what it actually means, which is why you prepare as much as you can for potential scenarios. But I think, yeah, any increased tariffs are obviously impact on the end user, and as a discretionary purchase become just another barrier to sale.
Well, I wish you well, Steve, and I constantly think of you and that visit I had, an iconic brand, and I'm just glad you're a British one. Well done, and thanks very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you. And so let me take you from Malvern and let's pop across to Warwickshire and let's go to Stratford-on-Avon. Now, you might think that's quite an unusual place to find a manufacturer, the home of Shakespeare, but there's a well-known brand of another sort of vehicle there. They're Pashley Cycles, and I have two special places in my affection for Pashley. One is that the first lady who ever taught me to read when I was sort of, I don't know, 3 or 4 or whatever I was, 2 or 3, was Miss Pashley, and she was a Pashley of the bicycle fame. So it goes back a long way. And then in 1998, I got on a bike and I rode it from John O'Groats to Land's End to raise money to keep Birmingham Hospice open. And we were pretty successful at that. And, you know, in the whole time, the bike never let me down once. In fact, I only had one puncture, and that was on the last morning down in Cornwall. And that bike was a Pashley. And they very kindly donated it to me so that I could raise money for the hospice. And to this very day, it's actually hanging on the wall in the Coventry Transport Museum as a sign of what a Pashley bike just made just down the road can do. And it's a smaller company than Morgan. It employs just 60 people. And one of them is known in the company as Export Dave. I'm not joking. He really is. David Hawkswood is the export manager at Pashley. Everything to do with getting one of the bikes out. And 15% of them actually go to the EU. And I'm really fortunate that Dave's with me today. And in fact, I understand you've just been dealing with a shipment to New Zealand, haven't you? Hi, Dave.
Hi, Digby. You okay?
Yeah, in good form. And thanks for giving us some time.
Yeah, sure. No, we have a very good customer down in New Zealand, and we regularly ship containers down there to them. So yeah, it's very, very fortunate for us.
What does what does export managers in a company of with great respect the size of the business? What does it actually do?
To be honest, you know, because we're much smaller than what people think. So it covers many areas, basically, from appointing dealers and distributors, literally, through to putting orders on the system, to getting payments in, to, you know, even packing goods, putting bikes on pallets, and ensuring that, you know, they all go in a container, that type of thing, basically. So, you know, it's a wide ranging role, which is great, to be honest. You get a lot of variety, and you meet a lot of very interesting people.
So, Pete, so someone at the other end who opens their crate and finds that it's a bike with one wheel, you're to blame, are you?
Exactly. You've hit the nail on the head. Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah.
Now, in all of this, and with the transition ending, and you must be looking at it and thinking, oh, what are we going to do? How are you specially preparing for it? What are you doing differently?
Well, it's one of those things. You have to, in business, you have to adapt, don't you, and go with whatever the current situation is. It's not obviously ideal because nobody quite knows what's going to fully happen, re-tariffs, et cetera, and whether we get a deal or not. But essentially, we know that there'll still be customers out there who want to Pashley bike, and we will endeavour to create the smoothest route we can do for our dealers and distributors to get bikes into the export markets for them. Obviously, we've got the restrictions that we don't know quite what will happen yet. Obviously, what any duty tariffs that may be applied to EU products that we currently fit on our bicycles, because essentially, being a British manufacturer, you know, we source locally as much as possible.
So do you do the customs work yourself, actually, Dave? Or do you get a firm in, do you get a consultant in, or do you actually do it yourself?
No, we do it ourselves, effectively, as much as possible. Obviously, we work with some very good freight companies, so we'll do the customs work, you know, custom clearances, etc. But obviously, we essentially provide all the details to the freight companies on any of our imports or exports to ensure that the correct duties and taxes are paid on them.
And is that the same for import? Because you actually do import a few of your components, don't you? You get your kickstands from Finland, I think.
Oh, yeah. Well, we do. Essentially, you know, we buy products from all around the EU. So let's take Switzerland, for example. So we bring in some good quality components from them. And but, you know, we do around the world. So we do. I provide all that information to the freight companies. And in a lot of cases, we arrange the shipping ourselves as well. So I suppose we're fortunate in the respect that we've been a importer-exporter for many years. So we know the processes, which I suppose is a key factor.
Given that you obviously are an expert in your field of doing that, and you're also dealing with a value-added product, everything that British manufacturing should be, frankly, which is not selling on price, but selling on innovation and quality. And
it is, yeah.
You must, in your experience, have sat down and thought, I know this is happening, I know Brexit is happening, I better start getting ready.
Yeah.
When was that? I mean, was that last week, or when you knew you were coming on this show, or it was the week before?
Definitely, because obviously we were all expecting Brexit to happen many months ago, effectively. So we'd all put in ensuring that we got all the boxes ticked, effectively, that we got our commodity codes all lined up. We got knew which freight companies we'd be using to do
our business. And how long ago was that? Was that a year ago? Or?
Yeah, about a year ago. You know, we're all signed up. We've got our EORE numbers all in place. We've got our deferment accounts. And it's just how those things will come in. Obviously, for us, we're just looking as a business as to what extra costs it may add to our product.
Yeah, and I wish you well with it. And I think of those days sitting on my Pashley bike coming down from John O'Groats Land's End with great affection. So you keep flying the flag, mate, and thank you very much indeed. Thank you, Dave.
Thank you.
Well, Ali, what did you think of that? We've got two iconic brands. We've got one on four wheels, one on two. In fact, Morgan make a three-wheeler too. So we've got two, three and four wheels. What do you think of that?
I think in terms of what they had to say about planning for the end of the year, their ability to plan for the end of the year, it just it really came across that they're basically saying, look, we've done as much as we can do without knowing what the final detail is going to be. We've, your second sort of guest, we've have our EORE number. That's basically the economic operator number you have. Just that's the bare minimum that you have to do to be able to trade as a basically not part of the EU with the EU after the end of the year. But I think what came across to me was them basically saying it's not in our in-tray right now because we've done as much as we can do. But until we have, and I think what your second guest said was quite interesting. He said, we've done our EORE number. We work with logistics and freight companies. We're basically waiting to know exactly how it's all going to fit together to take action. And I think that's, to me, what comes across is that, I think without having that deal in place, there's only so much preparation you can actually do. So I think they're pretty representative of most companies, barring people who say we've relocated and opened up an office in the EU, in Europe to make sure that we can continue to not have to double test products in case we don't have a deal, for example. But, that's not a financial option for a lot of particularly smaller companies in supply chain as well.
One thing I sort of took from both of them is that they almost took for granted that they were doing this for some time. They hadn't started last week. I teased him about, did you know you were going to do it when you came on the show? But I mean, obviously, they've been doing this for some time. Do you find in your IOD experience that that is normal, or are too many of them waking up a bit too late?
I think it's hard to compare, where we were, let's say, last year, where I could probably give you a more reflective answer. With COVID, I think you have a lot more people who are potentially, I can only deal with the most urgent item in my in-tray. And I think that whereas that might have been less of an excuse to not be ready or be starting to get ready last year, I think it's a lot more of a valid justification at the moment, because if you don't have all the details in front of you, you're going to, and I thought there was an important word that your first guest used there, adjust. We've got a solid 40%, 30 to 40% of members of the IOD who say we cannot plan to be fully prepared, quite frankly, because we don't have the detail of what we're changing to. We can only adjust. And so that's both, maybe that might give the government some cause for concern, but I think it also reflects the fact that they're saying we will adjust whatever you give us. Just we cannot focus on it until you have all the detail right there. So it depends on your starting point.
Yeah, I suppose there's two things. They can adjust. But not completely. Yeah. And also they have got COVID on their plate they're only human. And the one that will go into the in tray and wait there is the one that's not of the morning. And the morning is COVID. Let me bring in at this stage. Let me bring in another one of the manufacturing heroes from the automotive sector. But this isn't one with wheels. This is one that makes things, that goes into things with wheels. It's a company called Entech. And it makes the polyethylene lead battery separators that go into cars and trucks. They're shipped all over the world. And the supply chain manager of the business, her name is Sam Fuller, up from Geordieland, up in Newcastle. And it's an absolute delight that she joins me now. Hi, Sam.
Hi there.
Tell me a little bit about it. Tell me where you ship these products to.
Okay, so as you said, I work for Entech, and we make polyethylene lead battery separator materials for the automotive industry. We're based just around Newcastle in the northeast of England, and the company operates out of three sites, one in America, one in the UK, and one in Indonesia. 100% of our product is exported.
100%?
100% of everything that we manufacture in the UK is exported.
And how many people do you employ up in Newcastle?
We have 136 staff here on site.
So 136 people make the polyethylene separators, and every single one of them earns money for Britain overseas. And what percentage goes to the EU?
80% goes to the EU, and the remaining 20% goes into the Asia-Pacific area, the Middle East, Africa and South America.
And of the 80%, have you got a major market? Have you got like Germany or France or something?
West Germany is the major market. Or Germany, yeah. As it is now, yeah, Germany, my apologies.
Yeah. Where they make cars, really, I suppose.
Yes, yes.
What do you do as a supply chain manager? What do you actually do? Do you have to make sure they get there?
Well, yes, it's really from end to end in terms of my role. So I deal with the importation of the raw materials and then work with the customers and the supply chain team after manufacturing to ensure that the product gets to the customers in the time that they want it and in the quantities that they want it.
Yeah, and so you've got Brexit coming down the pipe, or rather the end of the transition. So how does what you know is coming, how's that involved you, and what have you done about it?
Well, as a business, we've done quite a lot of training in terms of with the assistance of the Chamber of Commerce here in the UK, our tax advisors. We've been monitoring government websites for any pertinent updates. In terms of our imports, because they come from all over the world, apart from possibly congestion at port, there shouldn't be that much impact in terms of our imports. We're more concerned really on the export side, but we have been proactively working to try and minimise any impact that could happen to our customers.
The guys who buy off you in Germany and France and wherever, are they bigger than you? Are they the OEMs?
No, they provide into the OEMs.
Right, right. So they're not in a position where they can take additional stock off you and stockpile in case?
They are. They are actively doing that, and they've sought additional warehousing to be able to do that. And as well as I think the lady that you were speaking to before, we obviously have had the challenges of COVID to manage, but we are managing to support them with everything that they've requested from us.
Yeah, and presumably, if you can sell, should we say in advance, make sure that it's stockpiled, it doesn't hurt you financially because they're going to buy off you ex-works, aren't they?
They are buying off us on an ex-works basis, yes.
Yeah. So in other words, it leaves your factory gate and you get paid?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Can I come and work for you, please? That's a wonderful way of doing
it. It is a good company to work for, I have to say.
In terms of looking at it down the pipe, is there any one thing that you... a question you've got about Brexit, that other than the, can you tell me whether there's a deal or not? But is there something that you think, I wish I could be told this, or I wish I knew this, and where could I get it from? Is there anything you go to bed at night thinking, there's a bit here, I've got a bit of a gap here?
Well, I think you're right. It is the question on everybody's lips in terms of deal or no deal. But I think more, the only thing that I would say that it's very 11th hour is the fact of the documentation that's required to be able to clear customs, both inbound from Europe and outbound from the UK, because there hasn't been anything finalised as yet on that.
Well, thanks very much and good luck and well done. And the fact you're 100% exporter, I'm not going to forget you in a hurry. Well done. Thank you very much.
Great stuff. Thank you very much.
Well, Ali, what did you think about the fact that, you know, the last answer, actually, this thing about... the documentation side of life, the forms, if you like.
The calls that I sit on with government day in, day out, week in, week out for the IOD. If I had a nickel for every time a civil servant said, we can't really provide that right now because it's being negotiated. And I think where that becomes relevant to what she was raising is that simply to say, we know that there are custom forms, let's say, because I'm going to pick that line up. She talked about basically the forms you need to get things in and out. We know that the forms are going to change. We don't know what forms are going to be considered acceptable because that's literally what the detail of the UK and the EU are negotiating. So, for example, the kind of facilitations, if you're trying to cut down on your cash flow, sort of, particularly for cash flow management purposes, there are certain customs facilitations that we don't know at the moment whether they will be acceptable to the EU after Brexit carry on, you know. And I think this is one of the challenges for exporters that may be importers. You know, if you're an exporter or an importer, you're looking at this very differently. And I have to say, it's not just people who trade directly who are going to be affected. If you're an exporter, you're sitting there and thinking, I don't want to lose any, you know, that's the ultimate thing that I want to make sure I don't do anything here that's going to lose my business, that customer's business with me. So some people, what we're finding, businesses are maybe not speaking up as loud as they should to sort of go through all the different scenarios, because effectively, unless they are 100% confident in what they are selling, you know, that relationship cannot just be substituted by another continental European provider. Yeah. You know, you find that they're a little bit nervous about frightening the horses, whereas importers are less worried about that.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Digby Jones. I'm former Director General of the Confederation of British Industry, and I'm also former United Kingdom Trade Minister. We're talking all things Brexit prep here on the first of the series of these programmes. And we've looked at matters automotive. And with me is Ali Renison from the Institute of Directors. I'd just like 1 minute on automotive, Ali. If you could just put the manufacturing statistic into context about how important or not automotive is.
Well, not only, I think, in terms of importance to the economy, but in terms of, I think, looking ahead to the end of the transition period. You know, well over half of our car manufacturing exports go to the EU. And so I think while they tend to be more diversified than some of the other manufacturing exports, it's crucially important simply because you have a lot of British brands and the consumers in those markets, both in Europe and non-Europe. It's a big part of why they buy from the UK.
A lot of people work in automotive, don't they? And in the supply side as well as the OEMs.
Oh, yes. I think, interestingly, I was looking at some stats on this the other day. And not only is it, you know, it's not a huge part of the economy, but for what it actually gets out of it. I think the rate of return for manufacturing, not only in terms of the people employed by it, but on average, I was looking to see that the wages of people in manufacturing are on average about 15 to 20% higher. So it's not only, I think, punches above its weight, but in terms of how it punches above its weight, it's a big, big time employer. So people tend to have a lot more skills in some of these sectors than in others.
Yes, because an OEM, an original equipment manufacturer, the names we all know, the car makers, if you like. But of course, it's the filter down from there, isn't it? It's the smaller suppliers, the small businesses. So many of those these days, you know, you could eat your lunch off the floor of these places. I mean, they are high-tech businesses.
If you were to take that into account, if you were to take into those supply chain links into account, which is why it's so important, and that's why whenever we hear about sort of potential firm that might go under, you always hear about the supply chain jobs that are at risk. So if you were to take those into account, manufacturing is actually responsible for about 16 to 22%, almost a quarter of the economy, and 18 to 27% of employment in the UK. So it really does punch above its weight.
And responsible for the morale of so many places of work, where lots and lots of small businesses all beavering away, employing just a few people, maybe one apprentice, and so important. And SMEs, the small and medium-sized enterprises, are so important, the lifeblood of our economy. We're going to actually have a look at them in detail in another one in these series. But I wanted to contrast it right now, actually. And instead of talking to a bigger business, let's talk to a small business, but a very, very important one. And let's move it away from wheels. And let's get into what you might call really 21st century business. And Dr. Chris Elmsley, he's at Fibrecore.
Hello, Lord Jones.
Thank you so much for joining me. Just tell me a little bit about what you do.
Well, Fibrecore develops, manufactures and sells worldwide highly specialised optical fibres. We span out from Southampton University in 1982. I've been involved since the very, very beginning. And at last count, we sold in something close to 60 countries worldwide. And in a good year, we're exporting upwards of 98% of what we manufacture here. So we are hyperactive exporters.
Yeah. And where are you? In the UK?
We're based in Southampton. So we're just on the northern outskirts of Southampton, at the Southampton Science Park.
So we've done Newcastle to Southampton today. That's not bad, is it?
My place of work. How interesting.
And in your exports that you go, you know, virtually all of them are going to export, what percentage goes to the EU?
There's between 30 and 35% goes to the EU. And that's been pretty constant for certainly the last couple of decades.
And then in the last couple of decades, well, before then, of course, a long time before then with the single market. Do you remember, I can remember, you used to have Carnets and Qs and all the rest of it.
I remember very, very well driving around Europe with stuff in the back of the car, trying to get across borders at midnight in the snow with guys not wanting to come out of their little cubicles and then stamping the wrong bits of the carnet when they did. So there's a big part of me is saying, well, how bad can it get, frankly?
Yeah, I think, you know, when I was used to use the phrase that you could make something in Birmingham and sell it in Barcelona on a VAT invoice receipt. And that is a single market working well. And we don't know, do we, where this is going to end up in the negotiation. But you would hope that the manufacturers of Europe, not just us, don't want to have their carnets stamped and don't want to sit and stand in the snow either. You would hope this was a bilateral, not a unilateral thing.
It certainly works both ways. And that, although we have various plans in place, that is what I'm banking on.
And how would that specifically affect you? I mean, are there any areas where you think, I'm getting ready for this anyway, I'm ahead of the game, I know what I'm doing?
Well, I mean, first of all, we've done it before the single market. We've got first-hand knowledge of how bad it could get. And I certainly don't envisage a return to those times. In a worst case, World Trade Organization, most favored nation status. As far as I can see, the tariff on optical fiber for that is 2.9%. So until something better comes along, I can certainly absorb 2.9%, employ some extra staff here at Fibrecore House to sort out our large European customers' exports. And I really don't see that being a problem, and I only see it being a temporary thing. My biggest concern, to be frank, is the confusion and the chaos that is being predicted surrounding the new year.
Yeah, you don't quite know where it's going to end up.
You don't quite know just how long before that is it going to start impacting.
How do you sit there and plan for something you don't know what's going to happen?
You can't. That's what we were saying at the very, very beginning back in 2016. You know, we can cope with anything. UK business, I think, is extremely resilient. And provided we know what, you know, what is happening, I think we're all smart enough and we're all inventive enough to find a good way of handling it.
your raw materials, which you presumably can't get all of it from Britain. So are you finding a problem with that, and are you getting ready for that?
My raw materials, but ours is a business of knowledge and expertise. My raw materials bill is roughly 8% of my selling price.
Yeah.
So it's not huge.
And where do you get it from?
All over the world. A lot of the chemicals come from Japan, for example. Hopefully the Japan deal will be replaced. Will soon be in place.
Yeah.
We source some of our substrate glass from Germany.
And have you been stockpiling that at all?
I have 6 months in stock.
Right. And did you always have 6 months in stock?
No, I used specifically to keep about, for this. I used to keep about 6 weeks.
Yeah.
So we've had 6 months in stock now. Since I actually forget when it was the first time we were definitely going to leave.
Yeah.
But we stocked up on all raw materials, not just those coming from Europe, because of the aforementioned potential confusion.
Yeah. So in terms of buying and selling from the EU, ticking the box for making sure that if there were delays, you've got enough pudding in the system to cope with delay.
We've definitely got enough pudding in the system. And to be frank, next week we'll be contacting all of our major European customers to reassure them of what we have in place, and to suggest if they are still concerned, they might like to stock up themselves.
Chris, can I just thank you very much? And, you know, you're obviously a 21st century business. You're obviously something that's really going forward in what we might call the new economy. So I thank you and I wish you well. Have a good Brexit, my friend.
Many thanks, Lord Jones.
Well, Ali's still with me. And something I've noticed through a common thread at the moment is that a degree of holding stock, whether it's getting your customers to hold stock or whether it's you holding stock in from your imports. But they are... If there is going to be a delay, businesses seem to be stockpiling a bit, and that presumably at the moment is a good thing.
That's if more people were doing that, I would feel probably a lot more relaxed about what scope for disruption there is, or the impact of disruption of the border on traders. Because we did some data on this, and whereas I think in September last year we found that basically just shy of a third of people who were affected were stockpiling amongst our own membership. This year, I should say, when we did this in September this time around, 15% said that they had done it now, and another 15% had said they were going to do it. And I thought that actually interestingly reflected that, you know, some companies, I think, depending on how much you have to, just have no other choice but to, as you said, have more in the pudding there stocked up. But for a lot of other companies, particularly the smaller ones, they're so desperate, depending on how COVID has affected them, that not everyone has the same ability of resource to hold stock. So it depends on where you are in the supply chain. But he's certainly in a position to be able to, so probably in a better starting point than others.
Let us move on, and let us move from Southampton and let's go to my homeland, a city from in my title, and that is Birmingham, born and raised and proud of it. And in a way, you know, everybody always thinks automotive, they think cars when they think West Midlands. But manufacturing the West Midlands is bigger, it's better, it's world class in so many areas that have got nothing whatsoever to do with wheels and making a car or a truck or whatever. And so I want to take you to two companies that I have known well all my adult life. I put their success down to their lawyer that they used. That was me. And I thought we'd, instead of having a parade between the two of them, I thought we'd have a three-way round the table of Tom Wesley, Stuart Toe, and myself. Now, we'll take Tom first. He heads up a group of companies that manufacture all loads of things, from sculptures. In fact, I've got one in my lounge at home, but he does them for Damien Hirst, a bit more famous than the one I've got, to protective clothing for our lads in uniform when they go into harm's way. They're being protected by something made in Cradley Heath in the West Midlands. Employs about 250 people in the UK. Tom, welcome. And thanks so much for joining me. And just explain a little bit about all the companies and what you do?
Well, there's two divisions, really. The principal and the original business is all about a foundry business. So we specialise in copper-based and nickel-based alloys. And as you say, that's the constant. The end applications are marine propulsion systems, anything that's got to live in seawater, firefighting systems, and, of course, large bearings for ships and parts for increasingly for the art world and, you know, a lot of offshore oil and gas. So it's quite a diverse range of end markets. The constant theme is the special material. The other part of the business is obviously with plastics. So we've got about 250, 300 people, as you say, in the metals business. And the plastics business is about 50 people.
And I think I'm right. Anybody who walks over Westminster Bridge and sees the House of Parliament on the other side, Portcullis House, where the MPs all go, all that black metalwork on that stonework there, I think you did that, didn't you?
We did, yes. That was an unusual project, but they come up more regularly these days as people want sustainable buildings. So the whole of the facade at Portcullis House is bronze. So it's zero maintenance. Yeah.
And very few people will know that came straight out of the West Midlands. It's fabulous. Let's move to Stuart. And hello, Stuart.
Good afternoon, Digby.
Hi. And Hadley Group is a wonderful business in West Bromwich. And as I was talking matters politic, I will just tell the listeners that your registered office is a place in West Bromwich called Downing Street, which I always think is absolutely marvellous. Your vocation was missed, my friend. And cold rolled steel, everything from the wire trunking that where the wires go down in buildings, all that trunking that you see in concert halls and arenas and car parks and airports, and then also metal framed houses, which will be a new way of building affordable housing in the future, which you do a lot of. How many people do you employ?
400 in the UK and 700 worldwide, with operations in Holland, in Dubai and in Thailand, and to be opening up in the US hopefully as soon as we can, January, February.
And the export side of it, so not the stuff you do in Holland, but the stuff that you do in Britain that you export out of Britain, is that a lot? Is it few or what?
Well, you've been hearing a lot about the stockpiling issue, and for us, probably 30% of what we produce is export. We bought the business in Holland 5 years ago with, to an extent, Brexit in mind, because it means that our stock holding, which you've been hearing about, can now be in our European customers' backyard, and they don't have to worry about the channel and the customs issues if we're increasing our stock levels in our Dutch business. So we've increased warehousing in that particular area. But the whole thing, I think, about this program is to ensure that people are aware of how they can minimise the impact on their customers and continue that relationship as an exporter, so that the customers have the minimum of a problem with dealing with a UK company. And so what we've all got to be doing as business people is ensuring that we know exactly what we're meant to be doing and what they're meant to be doing. So getting an EORI number, that's Economic Operator Registration and Identification Number, starting with GB to make sure that you're ready for 1st of January, is really important.
And when did you get yours?
Well, we've had ours for some time, but the new GB issues have only been out for the last few months, and if you want to export from 1st of January, you have to have that number available to make sure that you're registered for operation as an exporter.
Yeah, and Tom, you must have had your number a long time too.
Yeah, we've got EORA numbers for several businesses. It's a bit like the VAT number. It has to be dedicated to a particular company. So most of our companies do export. I'd say the plastics business exports nearly 90% of what it makes, whereas the metals business probably 70%.
And of those two, Tom, what percentage of those exports go to the EU?
About a half in each case.
Yeah.
About a half to the rest of the world, half to the EU.
And I know that you wish you were never here, I know, and I respect your views as a Remainer, but this isn't about whether we like it or not, this is all about planning for something that's going to happen. So in that respect, yeah. when you were a reluctant attender at the feast, if you like, when did you start to say, right, I've got to get ready for this, whether I like it or not, I've got to do it? When did you start that?
Well, day one, I started that. And I was thinking about the implications. But you know, the problem is, as you said earlier, it's things that you cannot control. Now, my customers, what Brexit did, of course, was change the mood music. So all my customers think, oh, my goodness, you know, West is no longer going to be in the EU, blah, blah. So what that has meant is that they have made their own plans, and they've started to, in the beginning, in the first few years, they thought we're going to have a deal. Everything's going to have a deal. It's going to be fine. Yes, you'll be fine, I reassure them. But now as we cruise towards the deadline and we see no deal, I can assure you we've lost significant business in the last couple of, well, 18 months particularly, when my customers see it as a risk mitigation exercise to not be dependent on the UK in the same way.
What have you done to deal with it? Because I know you very well. You will not have sat there and put your head in the sand, Tom. So what have you done?
Well, personally, I've tried to promote the relationships with individuals in the companies as much as I can.
And Stuart, you will have had your customers not just of the West Bromwich facility, but also your customers around the world. And what have you done about making sure that the mood music hasn't hurt your business?
Well, the mood music for us is that Hadley's is a global business with operations elsewhere in the world. And if there are significant tariff barriers or problems with documentation, we have undertaken to our customers that we will produce their goods in a place local enough to them to be able to not impinge on our commercial effectiveness as a business. So by either holding stock or even moving manufacture if necessary, we are guaranteeing our customers that we can continue to operate for them without a problem.
Very quickly, in one or two sentences each, and I've known you all my adult life, as I said, and I'm full of admiration for your businesses. So I just want to know if there's one thing that you think you could cover off, if there's one thing you could do in the morning to get ready for January, what would it be?
Well, I think, again, it's about finding out, in business, what are we about? We're about ensuring that our customers get what they want without a prejudice associated with it. So we want to ensure that our customers can have the same goods that they can have under their current arrangements without any tariff implications or hold-ups or other issues. And by doing that, we bought the business specifically in Holland to ensure that we could offer alternatives to them, because let's face it, as it evolves post 1st of January, there are going to be customs delays, there are going to be questions about customs declarations and how you export goods under license systems into the EU. While we're learning those things about additional marking that we may need, additional labelling that we may need, VAT at 0%, customers import declarations that our customers may need, while we're learning that, we need to take the hassle away from our customers, because if they see it as a detriment, as Tom has said, then they will make that decision, and you can't afford to be seen as a detriment to them.
Yeah. And Tom, in a sentence, what would you like to cover off?
Well, what we've tried to do, and we've been doing this latterly, is to tell them that forget about the tariff, because the tariffs on our products actually are quite modest, 3-4% or something. And the way the currency exchange rates wag around, we've tried to reassure them on the basis that, look, forget that, because you can, if you like, we can absorb that within the currency movements. And because Brexit's been sort of disaster for the value of the pound sterling, i.e. we're depressed its value by about 20% or so, that actually makes that quite tolerable at the moment. And I think customers like that.
It's good of you to be so frank, both of you, in what you need. Can I just thank you both very much? Thanks for giving your time. And I wish not just the two of you, but your entire employee base, so important in my part of the world. I wish you all the very best. Thanks very much, guys. Bye.
Thank you, Luke, mate.
And Ali is still with me.
That was fascinating to listen to, and reminds me of conversations I have every day.
Well, I think we've been blessed there with, you know, there are two people who, if there was a word that came out for me, It was communication. It was the idea that it's what my customer wants. I'm going to use everything I've got for my customer. What would you say about that?
I think that communication, it's a double-edged sword in a way, but I think that that's exactly right, because it sounds so lacking in substance. And yet what we're finding is that some people just don't want to actually have the communication with their suppliers, particularly, I would say, with their customers. Because, and I think that even though he's much more ahead of it than some other businesses might be, I thought that your guest who was talking about basically the need to take the hassle away from the customer, that underlines really just no one wants to frighten the horses. And where I think that he's certainly taken that positively and said, we're going to try and make sure that we have conditionalities and provisions in place for, if things do sort of get messy at the end of the year, although he said that continuing question is, I think, the biggest concern for them, that they've had that discussion with their customers and it's not going to jump out of them out of the blue. I think what we're finding is that a lot of businesses are sometimes a little bit nervous about actually having some of these discussions. So, for example, Incoterms, if you don't have them, Incoterms, that sort of divides your mixture that people understand who's responsible for paying the duty or for any changes that might arise, for example, for tariffs being applied. We're finding that some businesses are quite nervous about speaking about these things because, again, if it just looks like A, a hassle, and B, you don't have all the answer to all those questions, you know, depending on whether you have something that if you're exporting to Europe, they can just replace or use import substitution or get from anywhere else, you want to make sure that you're not communicating that you're going to be an extra hassle. So it's taking, you know, trying to make sure that, for example, shipment routes as well. Have you looked into alternative shipment routes for if things get gummed up at Dover? Can you rely on a different type of port? So those are the kind of things that we're hoping businesses are looking at in the areas they can control.
We're coming to the end of it all, and I welcome your expert advice on some takeaways. You know, if I was listening to this, and I hope many business people are, and I was a businesswoman somewhere in a small business away from the centres of the big exporters, what takeaways could I have from you as an expert in what we've learned today and your views on it all that get me into a competitive position on the 1st of January?
I think my biggest takeaway from it would be trying wherever possible to not only just look at it in terms of pure compliance, but also what is it that I need to do to make myself as competitive as possible in this situation to make sure that I maintain those client relationships. That's the bottom line for me, is doing everything that I can to make sure that client relationship is maintained. Because for some firms, you know, you don't need to worry about trade changing that relationship if you've actually mapped out all of your pinch points of exposure beforehand. So having those discussions now, not on the 1st of January, with your customers and your suppliers.
And in terms of getting information, getting the real stuff, that I've got a checklist, I've got some advice, I've got some places I can go. I'm thinking Chamber and Commerce, IOD itself. I'm thinking government websites. What else?
I think that you mentioned there, not only, I think, cross-sectoral trade associations, like, for example, ourselves, the chambers who do some of those actual trade services, but also, number one, I think the sectoral trade associations are quite important as well, because they have some of that really up-to-the-minute detail by detail. The one thing I would say, particularly for exporters, looking at it going forward, there is a tendency for, particularly in goods and manufacturing, to think, oh, it'll be the same from Brussels to Bratislava. Well, actually, it's really worth making sure that you are checking on the ground, not just looking at the advice written coming out of, let's say, the European Commission or Brussels. Make sure if you're an exporter that you're not only having that discussion with your customers or suppliers on the ground, but also checking to see what kind of approach is the local regulatory or customs authority is going to take. Because sometimes that, if you know to expect that difference, even though in theory it should be the same across Europe, it can stand you in good stead, not only for making sure that you know for any disruption that there might be on the ground, but also some customs authorities are more facilitative than others. So I wouldn't call it gaming the system, but making sure you understand who's more beneficial, that can help you reposition and reorient your business in Europe to maximum effect.
And nothing forgives you if you don't look after your customer and if you don't stock up a bit on your imports so that you can cope with it. That is completely within your own control. Can I thank
Absolutely.
You, Ali? You've been a star, and you've taught me, and you, I hope, given some useful advice and tips to everybody listening. But Ali, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you very much indeed for having me.
Well, that's the first in our series of programmes. We talked about all things manufacturing today. I hope you'll join me next time for the next in our series, are preparing for Brexit with Digby Jones.